Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, November 18, 2013, 50 years ago this week. Our nation was subjected to the traumatic assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Ooh, I'm glad I'm not a Kennedy. Imagine being a Kennedy, rule without remedy. To watch your family die, the world loves a sacrifice. Prophets long for the free, honoring the tragedy. The hunger for the crime, the privilege to take the life. Wearing the fame like a loaded gun. Gone. Tied up with a rosary. Ooh, I'm glad I'm not a Kennedy. Glad I'm not a Kennedy.
And is not peace basically a matter of human rights? The right to live out our lives without fear of devastation. The right to breathe air as nature provided it. The right of future generations to a healthy existence.
That's Shona Lang. And like her, I'm glad I'm not a Kennedy. I was 10 years old and coming back from gym class when we learned the news that on a visit to Dallas, John F. Kennedy had been shot and killed. I went home, we were glued to the television all weekend, and I was, like millions of Americans, a witness to the live televised execution of the alleged assassin, Lee Oswald, by a Dallas strip club owner named Jack Ruby. And it was at that point, even at the age of 10, that I began to process that this was not a simple case. And over the years, it has been revealed that there are layers and layers to the story of the events that led to the killing of Kennedy on that day in Dallas. And I am expecting that this is the only podcast I'm going to do about this commemorative moment. Personally, I'm averse to anniversary journalism. You know, 3 years ago this happened, 6 years ago on this day it was this event. Those anniversaries are not necessarily meaningful. It's just an excuse sometimes to revisit a given issue. And when I look back over these 50 years, and I look at the efforts of many, many people to get at the truth about the Kennedy assassination, I feel that we are no closer today than I was on the moment I saw Ruby kill Oswald. And so I have to say that this is the most successful conspiracy ever carried out, at least in my lifetime and in my awareness of history. And oh yes, you know, the loaded term conspiracy lives on today. Last night on Sunday, I watched an hour and a half or so of a special on CNN, and it wasn't a bad recapitulation of those events and the sequences since, as various people tried to get to the truth about the Kennedy events. And it does wash over us with our own memories and recollections. And it's complicated. I was, as you know, 10 years old at the time, so I was about 7 when Kennedy ran for president. My dad was a big Kennedy supporter, and I loved my dad. And like any good kid, I adopted my dad's politics. It wasn't until about 10 years after Kennedy was killed that I started to critically examine not only the assassination, but the myth of Camelot. The way we raised the Kennedy family to a kind of royalty in this country, and it's still going on. Caroline Kennedy has no credentials, but she's now the U.S. ambassador to Japan. And I never really bought into what I do consider to be this myth. Joe Kennedy was a corrupt bootlegger who bought the ambassadorship to Britain. And I worked in Chicago and had my own political awakening, knowing that Joe Kennedy had manipulated the results of the Illinois vote in 1960 to make sure his boy Jack was elected president. The Kennedys owned property in downtown Chicago. It was a big place called the Merchandise Mart. And I certainly feel the tragic loss of both Jack and Bobby. But I never thought Bobby Kennedy was this paragon of virtue, a man who was going to rescue America from the awful path that it took after Jack was killed. And part of it has to do with the what we now know about the private lives of Jack and Bobby Kennedy. And I'm a pro-sex guy. I'm not a prude. But the Kennedy brothers were passing women around as mistresses, sharing them with mobsters like Sam Giancana. Yeah, I interviewed Judith Exner. She slept with mobsters and with both of the Kennedy brothers. And so I did my first radio talk show about the Kennedy assassination in 1972. And it was interesting in this CNN retrospective that they gave appropriate attention to a guy named Mark Lane. Lane was an author, an investigator, and a relentless self-promoter. And I interviewed Mark Lane on a number of occasions in the 1970s. And I was with Lane when we talked about the Zapruder film, when we discussed that the lone shooter, lone gunman, lone wolf theories about Oswald just didn't hold up to close inspection. And to this day, I don't believe Oswald acted alone. And in a moment, I'll kind of outline the various threads of conspiracy. But Mark Lane was followed by Gerald Posner, Vincent Bugliosi. I've done many programs examining the Warren Commission's report, and it was a whitewash. And so at a certain point, frankly, in the mid-1990s, I stopped exploring the Kennedy assassination. And it's not that I don't want to find the answers. It's that I think that the most effective cover-up in history, even 50 years after the events, makes it impossible for us to ever get to the bottom of it. Maybe somebody will, and when that happens, I will feel a sense of relief. But my estimation is that they did a very effective job. They created a house of mirrors, a world of mirrors. So that when you follow the thread about, well, was the CIA culpable? After all, John F. Kennedy had just fired Alan Dulles, who created the CIA with his brother, who was then Secretary of State, in the 1950s. The CIA was deeply involved in the transition of French control of the war in Vietnam to U.S. control. And one of the prominent theories is that John Kennedy was trying to resist both the Pentagon and the CIA's demands to widen American involvement in Vietnam. Then we have the thread about all those efforts to kill Castro, the Cold War frame, enhanced by the role of mobsters who had owned casinos in Cuba and were bitter and determined to see Castro overthrown so that they could return to Cuba as a center of vice and profit for them. I worked in Chicago. I never met Sam Giancana, but I talked to people who knew him. And there's no question that the Kennedy brothers, sometimes, I guess, using these girls as conduits or as ways to meet with the mobsters or communicate with them, that they openly enlisted the help of the mafia in trying to kill Castro. What cans of worms did that open up? Then we have the most powerful American in that era, J. Edgar Hoover, running the FBI with ruthless approaches to manipulating people, blackmailing them, preventing the rise of a new black messiah after Martin Luther King was killed. And there are deep suspicions that remain today, and there are threads of proof that J. Edgar Hoover either knew about or was involved with the efforts to kill Kennedy. And when you look at the anomalies of the John Kennedy assassination, the killing of Robert Kennedy by Sirhan Sirhan, did he do it alone? I don't think so. And ultimately the death in Memphis of Dr. King, and the whole James Earl Ray story, I've investigated that in great detail. Ray didn't kill King all on his own. There's somebody who gave Ray money to get him out of the country. I mean, when you add these all up, it abets a great level of cynicism, and I will readily concede that I am full of it. Cynicism, anyway. Then there is the issue of Oswald. As a young man, he was in the military. He bailed out of the military, you know, without a general discharge. He just left. He went AWOL. And then he showed up in Russia, where he renounced his citizenship and said that he wanted to embrace communism. And when that didn't work out, Oswald came back to the United States. And despite the Cold War mentality, and that we were just a few years past the McCarthy hearings, they didn't arrest Oswald. They didn't try to detain him or punish him in any way. He was assigned a CIA handler. And I want to mention, if you, unlike me, still have curiosity and you want to explore more deeply, I read a book this summer by a man I've never met, but I consider a friend, Hank Alberelli. He writes under the moniker H.P. Alberelli Jr. He's the guy who painstakingly blew the lid off the CIA's MK Ultra and other programs where they were dabbling in chemical warfare, biological agents, LSD as a weapon. And Alberelli's book is very detailed, and it's fascinating because it explores many of the unanswered questions about Lee Oswald. How he was a juvenile delinquent who lived in 22 homes before the age of 18. How he was sent to a mental hospital where he was treated by a doctor who had connections to the CIA's MK Ultra-related programs named Hartogs. And Hartogs, after it was disclosed that Oswald was the key suspect in the Kennedy assassination, said that he thought he was very dangerous and should have been institutionalized, but the files that go back to 1953 don't indicate the same level of alarm that he had, that he expressed to the media after Oswald was implicated. And there's so much in this book about the people who had contact with Oswald, his link to white supremacist, segregationist groups in New Orleans. The curious trip he took to Mexico City just weeks before the events in Dallas. The attempt to kill a judge that was attributed to Oswald in April of 1963 in Dallas. There are many unanswered questions, and Oswald, if they were looking for a patsy, certainly fit many of the requirements to be a patsy who could be framed for a major incident like this. And Alberelli's book raises questions about whether Oswald actually killed Officer J.D. Tippit, and many, many other issues. And I actually invited Hank Alberelli to do an interview about this book, and he declined because he was about to travel, and then we never really picked back up the thread. And I haven't asked him this, but I got the sense that he wasn't that eager to revisit it all, somewhat the way I feel. And so when you look at all this, you'll notice that in all of the coverage, there's an attack on people who embrace conspiracy theories. But nobody offers a definitive view except to say that the Warren Commission report was generally correct. Adam Gopnik took a lot of heat for a piece that seemed lazy by his standards that he published in The New Yorker a few weeks ago. And we had Cass Sunstein, who was an advisor in the Obama White House in the first term. He's back at Harvard now. But he's unloaded on people who buy into what they deride as conspiracy theories. Well, let's cut the crap here. There was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. And there are multiple theories because of the excellent job they did of covering tracks and creating false leads. There are a lot of distractions and disinformation that you'll find when you delve deeply into the Kennedy saga. And so the biggest burn I feel is when they attack people who are called conspiracy theorists. And one of the things we've always believed is that, well, over time, and as people get close to death, they will want to unload their memories. They will want to tell the truth for various motivations. And that's it seems to be a canard to me. And I look at the story of 9/11, and, you know, I don't believe the official account of 9/11, and I think the 9/11 Commission, like the Warren Commission before it, was a very carefully constructed whitewash. And we're only 12 years out from 9/11, and still we haven't seen the official story cracked by whistleblowers, truth tellers, or evidence that somehow just burbles to the surface. And I fear that 40-some years from now, when we hit the 50th anniversary of 9/11, that we'll be no closer to that truth. And so I feel that as I share this with you, that this will be unsatisfying to you as a listener to hear this podcast, and that you'd probably like to hear Peter B. Collins state flatly who he believes was responsible. I wish I could. One of the reasons I checked out is when James Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans, indicted Clay Shaw, made big noises about how this was going to bust open the case. And it was a complete dead end. In the early 90s, Melvin Belli, the infamous San Francisco attorney, would pester me to come on my talk show, and he always wanted to talk about his defense of Jack Ruby. But he was only exploiting it and trying to get attention. He wasn't trying to get at the truth. He wasn't trying to share his insider knowledge with the rest of us. And so the parade of people who have attempted to investigate the Kennedy assassination are a motley crew. Vince Bugliosi is some kind of an apologist for the Warren Commission. I respected the book he wrote calling for an indictment of George W. Bush for war crimes. But when it comes to the Kennedy assassination, Bugliosi has no more credibility than Mark Lane or Gerald Posner or many others who have profited from it in one way or another. One thing I will say is that the CNN retrospective reminded me that Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather, Cronkite the top anchor at CBS and Dan Rather who later replaced him, Rather from Texas, was there in Dallas, and always was deeply interested in the Kennedy assassination. And I give them credit as newsmen because over the years they did give voice to the challenges to the official story, to the questions about the Warren Commission, to the challenge to the single bullet theory. But at least in seeing some of their comments in the CNN package last night, they always came back to the conclusion that the Warren Commission is the best available explanation. And so I encourage you to follow your own heart and your own mind if you're still curious about the events of November 22nd, 1963. By all means, read up on it. Tom Hartman co-authored a good book about the Kennedy assassination. And I have to say that I wish I had an expert who I could call and interview and put on this program to answer our questions and give us some sort of closure, some sort of conclusion 50 years later. Sorry, I don't have it. That's my news and comment for today. Feel free to share this podcast with anyone you like. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.